sort of where we left off last time was really with Brown, I think, is where the tape ends, and starting to get into the emerging civil rights movement. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your last few years as a correspondent in the Courier and the kinds of changes that you saw in terms of the stories you were reporting on after Brown.
Well, my last years with the Courier, I worked with Thurgood Marshall on the cases that he was interested in. The big case, of course, was the Clarendon County case. And it was named because it was in the Clarendon County that everything originated. The legal name was Briggs versus the state of South Carolina, whatever it was. Briggs. And in law, they take the name of the case alphabetically, and there were 20 some defendants in the case, and being Briggs, he was one of the first, so they named it the Briggs case. That's all. But they had some 20 some odd defendants. The case was started before the NAACP got into it, a guy named, a lawyer named Harold Bulware out of Columbia, South Carolina had the first case. And it was, he lost it on a technicality that he didn't bring it in the correct court. And so it was thrown out because they said it was not in the jurisdiction of the court that he brought it in. So then these people got very much disgusted and went to the NAACP and asked them if they would take the case.
Yeah.
Well, Bulwell was also an NAACP lawyer, so he remained with the case. But Thurgood Marshall said, well, yes, we will take the case if you can get as many as a dozen, I think he asked for, defendants, plaintiffs.
Right.
And he was surprised they got over 20. They got over 20 some odd people. And he was surprised because it was a hotbed of racial prejudice. And, but these people were determined, and they knew that they were going to lose they knew first they were going to lose their jobs. And they lost their jobs, and then they lost their farms, and they were. Churches were burned and houses were burned and all of that.
Yeah.
But they stuck it out. I was surprised. And so Thurgood Marshall took it over, of course, and then as they say, the rest of his history, he won the case with under Judge Wheatus Ware. He lost it in the next appellate court and won, of course, in the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was, I think it was the last large case or story that I had with the Courier.
Is that right?
Large one. I had several smaller stories,
yeah.
But because of my location, I was on the front page of the Courier every week. See, I was assigned to North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia.
Yeah.
But it was always something happening
sure.
in these three states. And then the Courier, because I did write and take pictures, the Courier sent me everywhere. They sent me outside of my territory to cover cases.
Yeah.
Sent me as far as Florida, and then I went to Africa with Nixon.
Right.
But
I wonder, what was in Florida? What stories did you cover there? Would you remember? You wouldn't have been there for the Tallahassee rape case.
No, this was a case where a black woman killed a white doctor. She was going with him, and they were, or at least they had an affair, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And when he decided that the affair was over, she decided that it was not over, and she killed him. And I'd have to look that case up, but it was a very outstanding case. It was a man that a doctor had two waiting rooms, white waiting room and a colored waiting room. But he had this black woman that he was having an affair with. And then when he wanted to call it quits, she wouldn't let him. She killed him. And I had to go, down for that.
Yeah.
And I covered that case. I don't remember the dates. I had to look it up.
Uh-huh.
But the case, the Clarendon County case, or the Brown versus Topeka Board case, changed everything.
Yeah.
It changed everything for everybody in this country, because up until that time, we had been a strictly segregated, racial segregated country. White and black. And with this decision, it became a desegregated country. And the case of Brown versus Topeka Board made Plessy versus Ferguson case unconstitutional. And of course, the court knew what the law should be, but they were troubled about what effect their decision would have on the country in general, because they knew that it was going to be such a tremendous change in everybody's lifestyle. And in the decision, they hedged, because they said, well, we're going to rule. And they ruled against segregated community, all segregation based on race. But they ruled that it must proceed with all deliberate speed. You remember that? And in all other cases, but in most other cases, as soon as the law was passed, that there was immediate change, right? Immediately, the law became law immediately. But in this case, because of the situation, the court said we will move at all deliberate speed. Well, this changed everything. Black newspapers went out of business.
Yeah.
Because they were, by and large, they were protest organizations, and they didn't have the same things to protest.
Right.
Racial strife wasn't over, but legally, it was over. So, black newspapers went out of business. The Courier was one of them. They struggled for a while, but it was...
When was your last year with the Courier?
It was in the late 60s. I don't remember late 60s. Yeah. Of course, I went from the Courier then back to working with the North Carolina Central University.
Yeah.
And I went with them in 74. I remember that very distinctly.
Now, would some of the Courier employees have gotten work at, say, the Philadelphia Inquirer or other of the mainstream papers once desegregation took effect at the...
A few did.
Yeah.
Wendell Smith was a sports editor. And he was employed in Chicago by Chicago Herald Tribune.
Uh-huh.
And there were some others that were hired by Dailies. I didn't want to work for Dailies. I didn't. I had been offered a job with the Herald many times, but of course the salaries were not as good. No.
Lower than at the black papers?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. They used to ask me all the time, say, well, as good a photographer as you are, why don't you work for the Herald Sun? I said, well, the Herald Sun doesn't pay what the Courier was paying. And so it was, that was one reason. Then I was trained for a weekly.
Yeah.
And a weekly and a daily are altogether different.
Different, yeah.
Yeah. So I went from the Courier to North Carolina Central. I came back.
Is there a photograph, a picture that you took during your time with the Courier that stands out as either your favorite or one that just is still very vivid in your memory? One you're particularly proud of.
Yeah. That was the concert, the Marian Anderson concert. And that was on Easter Sunday in 1938 or 1939.
Yeah.
And that was my favorite. I have a picture in my file.
Can you describe it?
I'm sure to you.
Sure.
And I wouldn't want to go. These are the pictures. They are the plaintiffs in the Clarendon County case.
Would you know if Reverend Delane is one of these?
He'd
been gone by then?
No. Well, he wasn't gone. He tried his best to be aloof from it. He felt that he could work better in the background than he could out front.
I see.
And he tried his best to stay aloof from it, but...
Was it that he felt he was too much of a lightning rod? That...
Yeah, he just felt that he, in the background, he could be more effective.
Yeah.
Of course, it didn't last. He finally became the pivotal figure in the case. They burned his house down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was one of, from the beginning, right? He was one of the real.
He was one of the instigators and the
real fighters.
And what happened? I'm trying to remember these names. I'm glad you got this cut off. I might not. This was a church where all the strategies took place and where they were studying.
Now, when you were covering these stories, did you get to know somebody like Reverend Delane pretty well? Or was it just kind of in passing? You'd be down there for one day a week, and then you were back.
No, we stayed down. I was. Reverend Delane had a niece who was a student in North Carolina College. Then it was called.
Yeah.
And I knew her then. I knew her, and it was through her as me with the president.
Oh, right. How did you meet? This is President Ford. How did you meet President Ford? What was the circumstances?
I happened to been responsible for bringing him here to speak. It was the 75th anniversary.
This is to Central.
Uh-huh. What did it say, 75th anniversary? He came here.
It says 14 November 1975.
75th anniversary. Now, I hope I got on the back of here, because here's the guy who... Yeah, thank God. Because I couldn't think of his name. You see, the guy sitting here in the middle.
Yeah, what's that?
James M. Hinton. He was the focal point of the whole thing. He started it all. And he, he was the one that got Delaney excited about the whole case. Now you can put this on. I can tell you about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, Reverend, his name was James M. Hinton, who was in Columbia, South Carolina. And he was the chairman of the NAACP. He was president of the South Carolina District. He was president of the NAACP in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. He was a man that was as fearless as I've ever seen. In fact, he made, when I was in his presence, I was nervous because I just never know what he would do next. But he gave a speech. It was a summer school at Allen University, and he gave the commencement speech for the summer school students. Delaney happened to be a student at Allen University in this summer school program, and he heard Hinton talk, and Hinton got him so fired up and interested in this thing that he went back to Clarendon County and started this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
But he wanted to be in the background. And he tried his best to stay in the background, but he couldn't. Because, see, he was principal of school there, and he knew that he'd lose his job and everything. So, but that's one reason he wanted to stay in the background. Yeah. Another reason, I think he felt, he asked me about pictures. That's a picture that I like very much.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And I took that down in Alabama.
Do you know where in Alabama this was taken?
In Birmingham.
In Birmingham.
Yeah.
And just to describe for the tape, what is it we're looking at?
This is a mother who was riding on the bus, and it shows the a sign for colored patrons only. And this sign had pegs in it, and it was on a bar. And when a white person got on it, the white person wanted to sit where you were seated. Then they'd pick up the bar, pick up the sign, and move it to another. And you'd have to move. You always had to move behind that sign. So the reason I like the sign so much is because it shows mother and child. And it shows the kind of a country that this little child was being born and reared in, brought up in.
Yeah.
And that's even why I like it so much.
Do you know if this ran in the Courier? Did they run this?
Oh, it ran everywhere, yeah. Right. But I don't know. That's me.
Wow.
That's a picture of me and
the Vice President,
Richard Nixon.
You seem very comfortable with him.
I was. We were good friends.
Yeah. And he seems about as comfortable as Richard Nixon gets. Yeah.
Well, for some unknown reason, he liked me. I don't know what it was about it. But I don't have that picture with me. But it's a picture.
Yeah, describe the.
It's a picture of Marian Anderson in concert at the Lincoln Memorial. She's singing there. On Easter Sunday morning, Easter Sunday afternoon, around 4 o'clock it was. She had been denied by the Daughters of the American Revolution. She had been denied a concert at the Constitution Hall.
Yeah.
Nobody ever thought that she'd been denied. Nobody thought that that these people would deny her. That was in 39, and I think it's 39, 38, 39. But at any rate, these members of the DAR, Daughters of the American Revolution, decided that she couldn't sing there because she was black. And so what happened was, Mrs. Roosevelt got interested in it, Ickes got interested in it, and Mrs. Roosevelt was writing, she had a column called My Day, a daily column, and she decided that, well, if the Daughters of American Revolution were that prejudice, she would renounce her membership. And so when she renounced her membership, a lot of other people followed. They renounced it. But then they decided that the best place to have this concert would be outdoors in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And they could make a statement. That would, the whole thing would make a statement. Right. And so that's where she sang, was outdoors. And that was the picture I got of her singing outdoors, with the background and everything. Sure.
What is it? Which way are you? So is Lincoln in the background? Yeah. Or are you taking it from behind her?
No, Lincoln's in the background.
I see.
Yeah. I have it here, but it must be in that display. And if you needed it, or you would need a copy of it or something, I'd be ready to get it for you. But then we jumped it now from 39 to 54,
right,
back and forth,
right.
Of course. 54 was the decision that changed, as I say, changed everything.
Right.
The black newspapers went out of business.
Yep.
And a lot of black schools closed. And it was just what we had. We were working for desegregation. And when we got it, it meant the end of our jobs.
Right. And I'd imagine a lot of black businesses went out of businesses, the insurance companies. And
well, not so much insurance companies.
They did all right, or better.
No, they didn't do better. Before the segregation, before the Brown versus Topeka board, the banks and the insurance companies, businesses of that stature, had already come to the conclusion that black business was good business. Now, a lot of them had a differential, that is, I was told that the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company charged more for premiums for black than they did for white. They had a separate system. And but they took them. Now, as far as the banks are concerned, when the banks were in this area found that the Mechanics and Farmers Bank was making money, then they started accepting blacks over to black accounts. But it wasn't until they started hiring blacks that the real breakdown really came, when they started hiring people in the front offices, blacks, and when they start training them for higher positions and so forth, and then of course they became I'm sure that the Mechanics and Farmers Bank has felt it. They're not as strong now as they used to be.
Yeah.
And we had a building savings and loan that's virtually out of business. Because, see, one time in the early years, when the early years of the bank, when Roosevelt came in office, he declared a bank holiday. I don't know whether you ever heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
All banks were closed. In other words, he was trying to get to let them come back as those that were able to come back. The Mechanics and Farmers Bank, the black bank, was the first bank in Durham to open after the bank holiday. So people looked around and said, are you telling me that that's the soundest bank in Durham? I said, yeah, That's what it is. They opened it. They were the first one. They got a lot of Jewish business from stores that the Jews were running in the black community.
Okay.
They got a lot of that. A lot of that business. And
but that was an indication that they
were straight.
Yeah.
Sound. And well, it was. It was sound because it was. It had the backing also of the Mutual Life Insurance Company.
Of which one?
The North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance
Company. Oh, okay.
But I tried after the career. I tried some other little jobs. I started doing some work as a school photographer. And then I sold school jewelry. See what I could do to make some money.
Right.
And then some friends at North Carolina College came to me one day and said, we'd like to have you to come work with us. And I said, well, it doesn't look like it. You haven't made me an offer. So then they were testing me and I was testing them. So I said, you make me an offer. And they said, well, the reason why we haven't made you an offer is because what we have to offer now is...
I didn't mean to ignore you, but another time.
All right. They said, the reason we didn't make you an offer is because what we have to offer you now is really small. And, but we can guarantee you that it will grow fast as soon as we can get out another budget. So I said, well, bring it. They didn't know that I was anxious. They knew I was anxious to go because I was peeling around trying to find something to do.
Yeah.
So when they brought me the contract, and I said to them, I said, well, I can see why you're embarrassed with this, but I was happy as I could be. I didn't care.
Nothing.
So I took the job, and of course, they kept the promise that each year that the salary went up.
Right.
And but you asked me about Ford. We were having our celebrations, 1975, anniversary, and it was the. We started in 1925. So in 75, it'll be 50 years, wouldn't it?
Right.
That was our 50th anniversary as a college, the university. And so the president asked me one day, Whiting, but then Whiting was president, chancellor. He was the last president and the first chancellor. He asked me, he said, well, who do you think we ought to get to speak for our anniversary? I said, get the president. He said, the president? What president? I said, we don't have one that I know of. That's President Ford. So he said, you think we can get him? I said, I can get him. I wasn't too sure, but I thought I could. And that was because of my friendship with Richard Nixon.
Right.
So I told him, I said, now, I would do this if you would swear secrecy. I said, because if I fail, I wouldn't want people to know that I had failed on it.
Yeah.
So he said, yeah, okay. He didn't think I was going to get it either. So one day he got a letter saying that, sorry, the president couldn't call me. So the correspondence that he was getting was different from the correspondence that I was getting. So one day I got a telephone call. Said, "You lucky?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "The president's coming. An advanced team is coming in there, And the advanced team officer said, but you can't tell anybody. I said, I got to tell my chancellor. They said, you can't tell anybody. Nobody. So I lived right across the street from school.
Right.
So I went home and told, I had to tell my wife. She said, I didn't tell somebody. So I said, and they said, I couldn't tell the chancellor. I said, you think I should? She said, hell no. If they said no, don't tell anybody, right. Don't tell anybody. So they were coming in on the 2 or 3 days, the advanced team.
Yeah.
They come to look around, see where anybody could take a shot and all that. So when they came in, and they came in and told the chancellor that Ford was coming, the chancellor was on his way to New Jersey for a meeting or something. So he had to turn everything, good thing for him, he had to turn everything over to me and Dr. Simmons, a guy named Dallas Simmons, who was vice chancellor for university relations. And we met with the team. They told us they was coming and what to do, what to repair, and all this.
Right.
So he came in and spoke.
How is it that, who did you contact to get the president? Did you just call up the president's people, or how did you make this happen?
Well, Charlie had asked me the same thing. Dr. Friday asked me the same thing. I said, how'd you do it? I really don't know how we did it.
Yeah.
And it was, and we had some people behind the scenes pushing some buttons.
Right.
And I don't even know who they were or what buttons they were pushing.
Right.
But I do know that Nixon liked me a lot.
Yeah.
And we were in, what is it, 54?
This is 1955.
Yeah, 1955.
And it's a plaque from the Global News Syndicate.
That he was being honored and we were being honored at the same time.
And you got the award for journalism achievement.
Yeah. And he got the humanitarian award. And so we got a chance to sit on in the group together. We both were recipients of rewards and so forth. So we became friends.
Yeah.
And when he got ready to go to Africa, he wanted me to go to Africa, right, with him and all that. So.
Now, did you keep in touch with the president after, Watergate?
Oh, yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, I kept in touch with him. And I had more contact with him as vice president than after he was vice president. He had more time and everything, I said. And we corresponded when he was vice president. Had very little when he became president. But he wanted to know about a job, if I wanted to offer a job. Nope. I didn't want anything. The job, the experience that I had when we went to Africa, cooled me to working in the White House in the government, because we worked all day and half the night. And I said, that would kill me. Yeah, see. So I said, no thank you. I don't think I want to do this.
Yeah.
And I didn't. And I was smart, because all of them are dead and gone. I'm still here. See, we worked in Africa. We worked from sunup to way past midnight. And we were expected to be up in the morning, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, ready to work. I said, no.
Well, I know that Frederick Morrow, who was Eisenhower's special assistant, he died pretty young.
Yeah, I know him.
And was not altogether happy about his years in the White House, the way they treated him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wasn't, Nixon didn't indicate that he wanted me to work in the White House. He just wanted to know if I wanted to, position some liaison office somewhere nearby. He didn't indicate it.
But something in government.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you worked as a portrait photographer, right? Did you have a studio that you ran, or?
No.
How did you do it? You went to people's homes, or how did that work?
I was never a portrait photographer as such, but I had a friend who had a studio, and I used to play around in the studio.
Okay.
And he studied, this guy's name was Charles Stanback, and he studied in Tuskegee at the Eastman School of Photography. It was the only black school of photography in the country. He studied there, and we became friends, and I was always in the studio, and I learned some portraiture under him, and we did some.
Yeah.
But
his name is Charles Eastman?
No, his name is Charles Stanback.
Stanback, I'm sorry.
George Eastman put the school down. George Eastman.
Eastman is the school.
The Eastman Kodak Company. Right. George Eastman put the school down in Tuskegee.
How did, coming to Central in the early, mid-70s, how did the effects of desegregation affect Central? Could you see any effects in terms of the student body, or over the long term, how did it affect the institution?
No, we didn't affect it at all.
No. Did it, drive up competition for students with, say, UNC?
Well, a certain quality. See, UNC said that those top students, that they could offer tremendous scholarships for.
Yeah.
They said they belong to us. In other words, UNC said, well, the law says that we've got to have a certain amount of black students, but it doesn't say we got to have any of the dumb ones. So we're going to have money. So we got the money. And so it was a period of buying students. And they had the money to buy what they wanted.
Right.
And they did. In fact, they still do.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't have scholarship money, mm-hmm. and don't have it yet, but if we get some under this new man, it's in there.
Yeah. How about in terms of the athletic programs at Central? Do you think those...
Oh, yeah, all suffered.
Suffered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the...
Well, you take Ford and all those people that you got over Carolina, they would have come... We were getting all those people from Rocky Mountain that came in to knock on college. And we were getting the cream of the black athletes.
Right.
And when you look around and see your, I look at the University of Mississippi the other night playing basketball. Everybody was black. I said, I'm shocked. It's Mississippi. when teams came in here to play Duke and Carolina, if they had a black star on the team, that black star stayed over in the black neighborhood with somebody.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't stay in the hotel and couldn't stay at school.
I was wondering, were you part of, you must have been one of the few professional black photographers in the state, right? Certainly a pioneer.
I was a pioneer photojournalist.
Yeah.
There were some other photographers.
Right.
But very few of them were writing. See, now, I almost never took a picture that I wasn't taking it for a story to illustrate a story. Almost never. Yeah. Right now, people associate me as being a photographer. I don't want to compare me with other photographers, but they don't realize that I was a photojournalist and different altogether
from
photographer.
So in some ways, a writer first.
I started.
Then you take the pictures to.
I don't know which I started. I started out. I don't know which came first. I started out, I think, taking pictures.
Yeah.
First, I was recognized taking pictures, and back in 1939. Back in the 30s, early 30s, photography was crude. I mean, you had the film was not developed. We have a chromatic film. The highest ASA speed was 32. We take a picture of a woman, had lipstick on, her lips were black. That's what chromatic film did.
Yeah.
Then, in the middle 30s, late 30s, the panchromatic film came out. That was a green-based film. The speed jumped from immediately from 32 to 64. We thought that we'd be going to heaven. Then it jumped almost as quickly as that. It went to 125.
Uh-huh.
And from then on, it just went on up.
Right.
And, but we started out, and to get your correct exposure, you had to use a slide rule.
Mm-hmm.
Slide rule would give you distance from you to your subject and so forth. That just, well, flash, to compute flash and so forth.
Yeah.
Outdoor stuff would use exposure meter. Had it held up the exposure meter. And the exposure meter would tell you exactly what your precise is. what the light was.
Yeah.
And so forth. But now, of course, now it's digital. I don't even know anything about digital photography. My son is in it, but not me.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
You were part of a PBS documentary on photojournalists and the civil rights
movement? That's been everywhere. That,
I don't think I've ever seen that. What was the name of it?
It was about civil rights. It was about civil rights photography.
Yeah.
It was more about, there's a bunch of us. Yeah. I got a copy of it somewhere around here.
Yeah. You don't remember the name of it or anything?
No, I just remember what it was about. I don't remember the name of it. Well, it was PBS film. This guy came in there. And he photographed. He went all around. He photographed me and went down to South Carolina, went down to Georgia, and all around. And he photographed those who had worked in civil rights photography.
Uh huh.
But
did interviews as well?
Huh?
Did he do interviews as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he had us all up to Charlotte. Had the whole bunch, after he did the film, had the whole bunch up Charlotte to the University of Charlotte. But the other guys who, they might have had one or two experiences in civil rights, but they were not that whole thing. Uh-huh. See, that was my whole thing. And,
now, I know there was a younger generation that came on, like Matt Herron and Charles Moore. And some of the people that were down in Mississippi.
Yeah.
But they don't have the kind of range that you have going back into the 40s. I don't know that anybody has the kind of range you have. Was there anybody else working those stories? I mean, other than the mainstream white papers, there was nobody that did the kind of things you did.
No. Nobody else was right and taking pictures.
Right.
No. That Willie Earle thing that I used to see, that was mentioned in South Carolina. Then, of course, the very next year, I had one of Isaiah, what the hell was this? It was another mention.
Right.
And that was in Georgia. Can't think of his name now. But no, I didn't have anybody. And when I had to go on those cases, and I went alone, because I didn't want anybody with me. Because if I had to run, I didn't want to have to leave somebody. Because, see, I was making my own decisions, and my own everything, time and time of arrival and time of departure. And I don't want to wait around for somebody to say, uh-oh, so-and-so's back there. He got it. He's being tough luck. So I traveled alone. Isaiah Nixon was his name. But then when I just started working for the school in 1974, it was all PR.
Right.
Nothing exciting about it, but Ford's visit was, I guess, kind of exciting.
Highlight, sure. But how about after, when did you retire?
93.
So considerably, you stayed past the normal 65 retirement age.
Yeah. Nobody knew how old I was, and I wasn't. I was waiting to get a good pension.
Yeah.
So I could have stayed on, but they didn't want me to go anyway. Nobody wanted me to go. So.
Uh-huh.
I am.
What have you been doing since then?
As much of nothing as I can possibly do. Nothing. I was playing golf until I had a stroke.
Yeah.
And I haven't been able to get my coordination back to do that.
Yeah.
I think that's attributed to the stroke and to age.
Uh-huh.
And so I feel I'm lucky. Just to be here.
Yeah. Now you've done some. I know you've spoken to some schools, right, and some community groups.
Yeah.
Oh, this was a couple of years ago, huh? Nice. Historic Scottsdale. What's that? Well, I think that's pretty much it for my questions. Is there anything that you think we haven't covered that's important that you want to add to the historic record? I think we got most of it.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Great. Thanks a lot.